the devil awakens.
Maximus wrests his life from the underworld.
Hey boy, what in the world are you doing here?
He was elated with his escape.
I wanted out.
I set out now in a box upon the sea.
Vincent Farini was a profound influence on me as a beginning poet. And what he says about the death of the language and trichnology, it's true, our lives have become very complicated. The simple is over. But what does it do to report on all this? We all know it. A lot of what I feel about poetry coming out of the United States right now is that it's kind of, you know, clever whining, telling us what we already know. We already know that we're in a complicated place, and to get it back to simple is very important. I don't know how to break out of being a poet. It is my life. I do try to do more talking with people rather than reading. I hope to reach the stage of spontaneous poetry, that I can just say it as I sit in front of audiences. I met Vincent in 1972. He scared me. I had never met anyone like that before, who was so alive and so unabashedly loving towards everyone. And at that time, I was a housewife living a very comfortable existence south of Boston in a town called Duxbury. And I felt like I was dying. I felt like I was all closed up and in a big knot. And it was by going to see a psychiatrist after I had a breakdown for what they said was mother's nerves. I mean, that's 1972. They're calling it mother's nerves. It must have been something more than that, because all the mothers I knew had mother's nerves. But I had a operation, a hysterectomy for cancer when I was 26. And it terrified me. This terrified me. And the doctor said that I could die. And I said, how can I die? I haven't lived yet. And I really meant that, because I had gone from undergraduate college to getting married and having 3 children in 3 years. And I had disappeared. So the year after that cancer surgery, I didn't recognize anything anymore, least of all myself. I didn't know what was happening, and I wanted to live. I wanted to live. And I started to go deep in on that question. What does it mean to be alive? What is the meaning of it? What am I doing? I'm just changing diapers. I'm dressing these kids. I'm feeding them. I'm living this kind of desperate housewife life. I mean, they didn't have the big high heels, but it was kind of like the show on TV. And it was like something had happened to me. All my dreams had vanished. Everything I intended to be and do as an actress. So I began writing these journals and these secret poems to myself. And when my gynecologist sent me to see a psychiatrist, that psychiatrist immediately recognized that it was more than mother's nerves and said, ask me what I had intended to do before I got married, and I told him that I had gone to New York to audition, and I had won a Fulbright fellowship to do theater in Poland, because my native language is Polish. I didn't speak English until I went to school. But I didn't really want to go to Poland. I was always getting prizes for things that I didn't really want to do. I wanted to go to Broadway, but there was no such thing as just a prize to go there. But I did meet a man that was on his way to New York, and he kindly offered me a ride, and he became my husband and father of my children. That's how much I wanted to go to New York. But my dream of being an actress didn't happen because I became pregnant again and again, and then the cancer, and then the breakdown. So the psychiatrist said, "Have you ever written about your experience?" And I said, "Yes." I've been writing all this stuff and I've been keeping it in a drawer. And he said, "Please bring it to me." So in the next session, I brought all of these papers and left them there. And then when I went the next time, he said, "This is really good what you've written. I want you to go into Boston, the Boston Center for Adult Education, and study there. Take some poetry workshops." And that was the beginning of my coming back to life, because there I met like-minded others. So right away I saw that poetry for me was a life raft. It was a hook to save me. There was nothing in the suburbs of Duxbury in 1972 for me to hold on to. Nothing at all. So poetry became my life overnight, and it was at that juncture that I met Vincent. I went to a reading, and as I said, he scared me. I had never met someone who was sincerely free, sincerely loving, with no ulterior motive at all except to love you fully, and who saw the world very much as I saw it, a strange place that I had to keep adjusting to. So Vincent became a very close friend of mine, and I would say my first guru in the spiritual sense of someone who guided me, not in religion, but in how to open my heart and pour out the love that we all have that's just wants to be expressed, and we don't know how to get it out. You know, we're so tentative. This might be our last day, you know, the solstice here. I was always so hesitant and tentative. So it took me many years on a spiritual path, which led me from my small little provincial life to California, where I worked with and studied and lived with Native American spiritual elders from the Paiute tribe and the Warm Springs Indian Nation. And there, again, broadening, like, you know, when you throw the pebble in the pond, I was opening. My consciousness was opening. What I started to discover just in my own country was there were so many people like me. Not everybody was happy. They were just driving around their big SUVs with their kids in the back. Well, I don't think we had SUVs then, but people were just all bottled up with their angst, their fears, their hatreds, their jealousies, the lies and the secrets that we were forced to keep in those old times. And the further I went out and expanded, the more I saw that. I saw everybody. Everybody wants something to grab onto. And my path then took me to India, where my teacher there was the living master, Bhagwan Sri Satyasai Baba, who passed away in April, but whose teachings really resonated with me. Like the first simple teaching, love all, serve all. Well, that sounds very easy. Serve all is easy, but love all is hard. It's very hard. And then coming around to see where is this God that we talk about so much. And Vincent used to have an expression, a poet is a spy for God. But you know where that God resides, I came to find out. It's within me. It's in my own awareness. I'm a spy for my own life. We are all poets. We are all spies for God. We all witness. We are all the witness of what is around us. My theme today was the wolves of spiritual and material poverty. I think we all would say that material poverty, most of us think, or many of us, I used to think, if I didn't have a house, a home, if I didn't have a car, if I didn't have a job, if I didn't have someone of the opposite sex, because I'm a heterosexual, who loved me, then I didn't have it. I didn't have the whole enchilada. I really believed that. I thought that was poverty. Actually, when you place a ceiling on your desires, you find out how wealthy you are. You don't need that car. Really, honestly and truthfully, I haven't had a car for 20 years, and I got here all the way from India. You don't need it. Doesn't mean you can't have it. Okay? You don't need that soulmate. You know, we're the mate of our own soul. You know, I'm not against relationships, don't get me wrong. But as soon as you get in one, have you noticed? It's like this, because that's what a relationship is. Relating, reacting. So if you don't have that, you have freedom. The house, I don't know anybody that can pay cash for their home. So they either rent it or have to make mortgage payments. That means you're tied up to a job that you have to keep getting that money. The money for the car payments. And Vincent Farini, Sai Baba, the Dalai Lama, all the living and dead masters have been telling us that from day one. Why did it take me all those years to get it? Get it here, not here. It's here. This is where we get everything. This is where it all is. So why do I call it the wolves of spiritual and material poverty? Because we are full of abundance and we don't know it. We always think, well, I need this, if only I could get this, and then tomorrow this, and we're always over there. Well, all the present teachers, Eckhart Tolle and a whole gang of them, have been saying to live in the now. We get it up here, but how many of us can do it? We can do it. We just stop. It's just like a radio. You shut it off. You click it off. You stop it. You don't follow the mind. You really follow the heart. And Vincent was so far ahead of us all. He was doing this from day one. In his early, in his Hermit of the Clouds, he spoke about one day his wife, God rest her soul, and his mother-in-law, God rest her soul, left And he was alone. And he turned on, I believe it was a record player or maybe it was a radio, full blast, because he suddenly felt free. What a way to live. How many of us do have to live like that? Millions. Johnny Cash sang, I owe my soul to the company store. How many of us owe our soul? We don't owe our soul to anybody. It's your very existence, yourself. Recently, before I left India, I heard His Holiness the Dalai Lama speaking in India. I write about his teachings. I'm also a journalist besides a poet. And I write about his teachings, so I went to hear him. And he said, you know what kind of Tibetans we have now? You know, since China desecrated Tibet, all the Tibetans are escaping into India. I teach Tibetan refugees English. What happens by the second and third generation? They're not Tibetans. They're Indians. All of their culture is gone. So when he spoke, he said, Tibetans used to do the compassion mantra, the mantra that increases compassion within you. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Now, what Tibetans are saying is, Om Mani, Om Mani, Om Mani Padme Hum. Because that nature of grabbing, grasping, putting money as the prize is a universal illness. And I don't have to tell you that because you know it. If we were giving out dollars tonight, this whole room would be full. Or if a sports hero were going to be here, the whole street would be full. Because our values have shifted from our own selves to other people. We don't worship ourselves anymore. Our self is measured by what others are doing. You know, we are great. We are it. It's like the ancient wisdom which said, I am that. I am that which I am seeking. I am it. There isn't anything. There isn't anything that you, oh, I found it. This is my everything. No, that's backwards. I am that. And some of you may have read that book, which is quite interesting. So why is everybody seeking? That's part of our nature. We want to know, why was I born? What am I doing here? What is my purpose? So I'm going to, since I brought up about the Tibetans, I'm going to read you from my new book. I am Tibetan. In India, where I've lived for 20 years now, most of my focus is on working with Tibetans. Because when I arrived in India wanting to meet my guru, Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba, in the little village of Puttaparthi, which is north of Bangalore, I quite honestly could not relate to the Indians very well. It's a very diverse and sacred country that's new, it's only like 63 years old since it's had independence, but it's fallen into this big gutter of competitiveness. It's westernized itself. It's walking away from its own spiritual identity. The human values of truth, love, nonviolence, these are being set aside for money, power, the things that we have here in the West. So India, in many ways, is much more westernized than we are. We have assimilated an Eastern view, whereas they're taking this Western view. So it was very shocking for me to go full circle and be in the sacred land and suddenly see, my God, these people are going backwards. So I couldn't really relate a whole lot at first to Indians. When I had worked with Native Americans and studied with them here, my spiritual elders told me that they too had ancient chants that were 10,000 years old. They too have a culture that's 10,000 years old. But do any of us know too much about it? No. Unless we hook up with them and they tell us. Because if you go out to find books, most of them are very scholarly studies rather than written by contemporary Native Americans. Because the long tradition was to not write these things. It's something you have to learn with your own heart. So because I couldn't relate very well to the Indian people, because I felt like I was in the marketplace. I really did. It was more of a marketplace than I had been in. I befriended the Tibetans. I became friendly with the Tibetans. I felt more comfortable with them because they were estranged from their own place, and I felt estranged a bit from my own place. And in India, a woman alone is looked upon as deviant, completely deviant. Those of you who've been to India will know that. You have to be with a man. It can be your husband, it can be your father, it can be your brother, it can be your son. But you are nothing without that connection. You are just a sitting duck and not respected. And that is true even today. You cannot be a woman alone and expect to get respect in India. Whereas the Tibetan people will always give you respect, always, just as a human being. So I became very close to the Tibetans, traveled with them throughout India, got to know the story of their journey and their longing, their absolute longing to go back to Tibet. This book was a gift of a Spanish poet, educator, writer, who wanted to validate my work with the Tibetans, so he published this book. It was through his financial help that the book was published. So I thank Esteban Diaz for getting this book published. This is a very short introduction, and for some of you, it's repetitive, but I just want to put it out in the vibration. I want it in the atmosphere of Gloucester. It was known as the top of the world. Now it does not exist on maps made in China. In 1949, China invaded Tibet, a country with its own distinct heritage, culture, language, and a population of about 6 million. Under the tyrannical rule of China's communist dictator, Mao Zedong, one-third of the Tibetan people were killed by the so-called People's Liberation Army and cooperating agencies. Most Tibetans who could fled to India for refuge. Others stayed and fought bravely. A small force against Mao's unending supply of slave soldiers. Peace-abiding monks, nuns, lamas, rinpoches, and tulkus were slaughtered. Women were raped, brutally sterilized, their wombs cut out without benefit of surgery, and children were taken to rehabilitation camps to be brainwashed against their own culture. The 1949 land grab and violation of international law by China continues to this day. China threatens India that if it continues to assimilate refugee Tibetans and not keep them isolated and under constant scrutiny in Tibetan camps, there will be repercussions. China threatens the United States not to interfere. China is holding the world hostage to its pumped-up lies that Tibet belongs to them. Even historians are being swayed by the lies, not unlike those that claim the Holocaust never happened. For the record, under China's occupation, according to the International Campaign for Tibet based in Washington, D.C., all but 13 of the country's more than 6,000 monasteries were destroyed. All but 13. And tens of thousands of monks were killed or sent to internment camps. The tyranny has driven more than 100,000 Tibetans from their homeland and resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands and the displacement of countless others. Alarmingly, the situation in Tibet remains repressive. Chinese citizens are urged and even forced to migrate to Tibet. The idea is that the remaining Tibetans will be eradicated by intermarriage, thus threatening to obliterate what remains of Tibetan culture and identity. For the most part, the world closes its eyes and few tears are shed for Tibet. However, even one teardrop adds to a flood of outrage that could stop the obliteration of Tibet. So be it. Spiritual poverty. I spoke about that was going to be mentioned tonight. The wolves of spiritual poverty. What does that mean? It doesn't mean wolves. I chose wolves because they're so hauntingly beautiful, but they're also so starved and hungry. And spirituality, people think they're spiritual. We think we're spiritual. But what is spiritual impoverishment? Really, what does it mean? Hungry to love others, to be loved. We're starved for love. Why are we starved for it? Because we don't know how to get it out of us. Yes, we can love selectively. We can love this person. We can love that person. Oh, we're good with the old ladies, with the handicapped. Oh, well, we give money. We write checks. But we can't love. We don't know how to love. We've got to get it out there. We have to do it. It's like the 100th monkey. Just do it. So be it. Love. The next time you see somebody, shock yourself in them. Say, I love you. I love you. Oh, they'll tell you, I love you too. I've been waiting for it. Don't wait till it's an old lady who can't cross the street. Do it now with everybody. Such a great feeling, and it's an inner feeling. It's exciting. They're not telling us to love, yeah, the churches, they're reading. Jesus said it, yes, love one another. But we're still not doing it because we don't want to be locked up in those places of worship, because we are the temple. We are it. We are the message. We are the change. As Gandhi said, be the change. What does that mean? I don't have to invite people in for cookies and coffee. I can silently love them as I'm walking down the street. Just love and get it out. Wow, it's energizing. It's totally energizing to have this big love in you and to express it. Incidentally, I wrote this entire book in Dunkin' Donuts when I came to the U.S. one day, because Esteban asked me to write about the Tibetan experience, and I said I would do it. And I love this country. I absolutely love our country. And Dunkin' Donuts is a wonderful place because everybody is welcome. All castes, all creeds, all colors, all mental aptitudes. It's my kind of church. And wherever I go, especially where my mom lives in Vermont, in this little small town of Bellows Falls, I go there to Dunkin' Donuts in the morning. I don't have to buy a newspaper. I hear all the news. I get greeted by everyone. Good morning. That's such a great feeling. We don't have a caste system unless we decide to make one, a caste, color, creed system. But we've overcome those things. We can't slip back now. So the whole book was written in Dunkin' Donuts, so I should acknowledge their wonderful coffee. I am Tibetan. I am Tibetan because the blood of the martyrs of Tibet spilled into my hard heart and made it soft. I am Tibetan because in our tent in Bodh Gaya, the prayers of the refugees to Buddha, to the deities, to the mountains, to the sky, and to the clouds reached my ears. I am Tibetan because the tears they cry for their motherland fall out of my eyes. The stories here are true. I cast them in poetry form because, I guess, because I'm a poet. I did not want to leave. My name is Lobsang. First I saw the fires, then the people running with bags on their heads, children in their arms. An old monk hobbled past my doorway, saying that the Chinese military were obliterating the monasteries, killing the Tibetans, burning all the pictures of His Holiness. There had been whispers Mao Zedong was destroying Tibet, eradicating Buddha to make way for a different kind of liberation, the one that money buys. His Nazis were called the People's Liberation Army. His Gestapo wore khaki and were using our sacred tankas as toilet paper. Even the tulkus could not escape. I was 13 when the 6 soldiers found me hiding under the cow dung pile with my little sister. They raped her first, over and over, until she died. When they sodomized me, I felt my life fly away, but I have lived to tell our story, the old ones say. I am immortal. This is a Tibetan nun speaking. Taking refuge in Buddhism, in Tibetan Buddhism, the person takes refuge in the Buddha. So that is what taking refuge means. And the Buddha, they don't mean the material Buddha, Siddhartha the Buddha. It means the higher mind, the higher self, the higher consciousness. When you take refuge, you're actually taking refuge in emptiness, which is within you. So this is a nun. Nuns are called Anis. At the convent where I live, at the Tibetan camp in Mungud, I take refuge in the Sangha, as my religion teaches. But it is the sacred land of Buddha, Mother India, who has welcomed us as refugees. I honor her like my savior. His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama, so young he did not have to shave, rode on a white horse into Nehru's country. The Indians understood the loss of home. Sri Mahatma Gandhi, small and frail, stood up to the entire British Empire, who were robbing and pillaging Bharat in the name of colonization. Dressed in a dhoti, armed with nonviolence, chanting Hari Om, Hari Om, the Mahatma's Bhagawan led India to victory. The British left, but now we are here, more and more still coming, kissing the Buddha's earth, tears of gratitude dropping like rain on the parched soil. We are a flood of escapee survivors. How can we repay such kindness? My name is Ani Omo. My answer is we cannot. Yes, I love you, Mother India. You have adopted me. You have raised me as your own. I was born in Arunachal Pradesh, but I am 31 years old, and I have not yet seen my real mother, my real home. Lord Buddha, forgive my attachment. Forgive my desire to see the snowflakes falling on So Manasarava. So Ma Pam, our holy lake, grant me refuge, Lord Buddha. This is an ordinary woman, like we women are. We're all ordinary. She's talking about her people. My people are breathing hard, every footstep guarded. No more Tibet on world maps made in China. I remember the size of my homeland, my husband's work-worn hands, his gentle acceptance when I told him my plan. Our son, I had to leave the body like a small brown doll. I threw it in the clear water and watched it sink down onto the riverbed. There was no time to do pujas for the dead. We kept running from the teenage slave soldiers who carried rifles almost as big as themselves, heading towards India and safety. I refused to call it freedom. I left the afterbirth a pink loaf for the flesh-eating birds. We were starving, my three daughters and I, but we could not eat that placenta, though I had learned how to do it. Survival brings redemption. It teaches non-attachment. I say my people have terrible karma. My name is Searing Dolma. What is my sin? When did it happen? I wanted to be a painter of landscapes, of yak herds roaming across the green grass. I wanted to copy the domes of sky, blue as my turquoise earrings, and baskets of stars plucked like coral from the mystery of deep sea dreams. Instead, my guru broke me like a stick under his foot. Now only the 58 wrathful deities commune with my inner being, and the pine trees, yes, the pine trees, refuse to ignore me, washing me in their fragrance when I walk through the woods where I remember everything, 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 except my most mortal sin. When did it happen? And this is what I ask all of you, to get those wolves of material and spiritual poverty satisfied in a different way. Put a ceiling on desires. Rip out the love cord or whatever that big plug is. Just pull it out. Do it. Tashi Deli, be so brave you scare the meek into action. Tashi Deli means hello, it means like namaste, it also means good luck in Tibetan. Tashi Deli, be so brave you scare the meek into action. Tashi Deli, be so loving you shock the hateful into remorse. Tashi Deli, be so happy you intoxicate the miserable into compassion. And I'm going to read one more poem so that if you have anything to say, we can talk about it. Waiting for his visa. As I said, I volunteer teach any Tibetan who wants to learn English comes to my house and I volunteer teach. Many monks have come. I've been graced with the presence of high lamas and Rinpoche's precious reincarnate masters that come again and again, and tulkus who are in Tibetan Buddhism believed to be manifestations of the Buddha mind. In other words, they spontaneously come into our presence like angels in a way to be with us. I've taken the Bodhisattva vows with His Holiness Dalai Lama, asking to be born again and again to come back until all of us are liberated. Freedom is no, I don't like all this stuff, you know, a lot of this stuff that goes on about, well, I want to be liberated, I want to be enlightened, I want to be free. It's no good unless we all have it. You know, what good is that? You meet these, I call them kind of new age groupies, but it doesn't cover the vast amount of people out there trying to get enlightened who don't have time to notice what's happening around them. you know, meditating, what is that? Okay, it's nice to meditate, but what are you meditating about? It's to be of use. How you get that, you grab that energy, that life force, that prana, to be of use. It's not just for you laying on the yoga mat and, you know, eating your vegan stuff. Yeah, that's helpful. I do those things. But it's a discipline for a reason. It's not to make me look good or be strong or healthy. It's to give me more, whatever you want to call it, God energy, you name it, so that I can be of service until I'm dead. And I took the Bodhisattva vows, hoping that I could carry that work on in the next life. And but one of the people that I had the great good fortune to meet was a very old Geshe. Geshe just means the highest studies you can do as a Buddhist monk, and you become like a doctor of philosophy. But I don't know what they're studying and all that. It's very difficult. But Geshe Jampa Dandu became a dear friend of mine and an inspiration to me. And he never learned English, but I knew everything that he ever communicated to me. Of course, there were translators, but he was the most loving human being I have ever met in my life. And I had accompanied a young widow down to the monastery when a young Tibetan widow, and they have a 40 days passing. When you leave your body, there's 40 days of pujas to help you on your way. As many of you perhaps know, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and have read it. It's the instructions for the dead, for the soul to find its way, or the spirit, or the self, whatever. So for 40 days, I was stuck in this monastery with this Tibetan widow who didn't say a word. She was a young woman, and I didn't even know her. But people asked me to go with her because the Tibetans were leaving our village and going to another place to sell their wares. They followed the Guru Sai Baba to the different places where he went to sell their trinkets and things. So I went with this widow, and I there in this little monastery in a very hot place in South India called Mungot met Geshe Jampa Dandup, who the minute I would lay eyes on him would just fire me up with love to give. I would just feel so loved. And the monks, you may have seen the old lamas, sometimes when they greet each other, they press foreheads. Well, he did that to me. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty cool thing. I don't know if it's what it was doing, but it was showing respect that I was equal to him. Do I get that respect around here? No. But I give it out. And that's what we have to do. We cannot wait anymore. There's no more time. But this is waiting for his visa. He was in his early 80s, and every year he applied to the Chinese embassy to get a visa to go to Tibet because he wanted to die in his own country. And he had come as a young man. When Nehru accepted the Tibetans into India, incidentally, His Holiness the Dalai Lama wrote to everyone and got no response except from Nehru. President Harry Truman, God rest his soul, said, "Good luck, kid." The Dalai Lama requested every country on the face of this small planet Earth to please receive the Tibetans. India did. India, the land of Buddha, did receive them. But at a time when India had nothing, they were in a famine. All they could do was receive the Tibetans and then allocate them to these wastelands throughout India and let them, you know, they were taken by trucks and various things. You can imagine crossing on foot, getting out of the top of the world, this beautiful plateau and mountains of snow and cold, and now suddenly being down in South India where just the climate killed many, no food, no tools to dig. Many old lamas told me they ate grass, they ate trees, they ate worms, which is against their religion, that they should eat, you know, kill something. But to stay alive, they did these things. And Geshe Jampa Dondup had done this as well. So every year he applied to the Chinese embassy because he wanted to go home to die. He just wanted to see Tibet. Well, he kept on living, waiting for his visa. And I do want to say that 1 week after my beloved guru, Satchasai Baba, passed away, so did Geshe Jampa Dondup. So I'm very happy I wrote this poem. And it's the last one I'm reading tonight. Waiting for his visa. Law in Tibetan is a respectful greeting, like sir or revered one. Geshe La has asked me to write a letter. He is so old, he still believes in the Indian Postal Service. He has gone 7 times to Delhi, sleeping at Majnu Katila camp, then standing in the long queue and sitting on the hard chairs at the Chinese embassy, then filling up the application papers for a visa to Tibet. He says he wants to leave his body in Lhasa, where he grew up eating momos. First his amalas, then starting at 4, those steamed in the big pots of the monastery. He never gets the visa, but he never gives up, propitiating the deities with saffron and dry grass smoke. One long white hair grows out of his left jowl, and he tells his new students, as young as he once was, "Don't pluck it! It is for good luck." We all laugh, gathering around his ancient feet. Geshe La has asked me to post another letter. He is so old, he still believes in the power of Sakyamuni's words. My name is Jamian. I do not want to be a monk anymore. Could we just have a little moment of silence to honor our unseen guests and each other and all those who are hearing the words? And I'm so happy you all came, and I can feel your love. And so we're going to be another big ripple in that ongoing ripple effect that's out there with your music, with your greetings, with your writing, with whatever work you're doing. We're all in touch with hundreds of people just in the course of a day. riding. I rode on that bus today. You can fill up a closed up place with love so easily, and nobody knows you're doing it. You're just sitting there and it's closed up. So the vibrations get locked in there, and love is contagious. It definitely is contagious. So, okay, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
I set out now in a box upon the sea.